Welcome to the MXGP Podcast Show on Vital MX. Your hosts, Lewis Phillips and Adam Wheeler, will discuss all things MXGP.
Woke up with a bend in the brain, stretching out with a cup of coffee.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the MXGP podcast show on Vital MX, the first episode of 2024, the first episode in quite some time, I feel, because I actually cannot remember the previous episode. So, yeah, sorry about the disappearance, but you know, Supercross has started, that takes preference, and MXGP has been quite quiet until now. There's actually a lot to get into on this episode, from Ducati to Prado to Argentina to
expectations.
It's a plethora of topics. But before we get to that, let me tell you about our sponsors, some new for 2024. Thank you to Polisport for continuing on for another year. We love the folks at Polisport. And you know what? I'm going to tell you about Polisport right now. Do you remember all the crashes and falls that you had and the levers that you destroyed because of that? Well, that's no longer a problem. Polisport released the Pivot Unbreakable Levers, a lever set that never breaks. If you fall, they can be bent back to their original shape. Easy as that. Incredible, right? Now that you know that your levers won't break, sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. And then we'd also like to thank two new sponsors for 2024, All Balls Racing Group, which for some reason I feel like I struggle to say that, like some sort of tongue twister. All Balls Racing Group? All Balls Racing Group is a combination of the finest aftermarket power sports brands from across the US and Europe, combining OEM level engineering and design capabilities with a world-class supply chain that makes them the largest global supplier of critical aftermarket hard parts for the power sports industry. Thank you to All Balls Racing. And you know what? Seeing as everyone's new and we're all excited because it's the first one of the year, I'll do the last read as well. So here we are. Thank you to EVS also for coming on board the MXGP podcast show. I like EVS. I had a very good talk with various EVS employees at EICMA. Learned a lot about what they have going on and what the thought process is behind their products, why they do what they do. I really got to a deeper understanding of EVS, and I've had a newfound appreciation ever since. EVS Sports, the original protective gear company, has been protecting champions and riders for almost 40 years and doesn't plan to stop anytime soon. What started out as one knee brace has evolved into a full line of protective gear to help keep riders safe as they do what they love. Check out EVS-sports.com to see the same protective gear that pros RJ Hampshire, Kyle Chisholm, Axel Hodges and Travis Pastrana all wear every day.
You're out of your comfort zone a little, aren't you?
I don't know what's going on. Why would I read Travis as travel?
Well, you know, I was going to say, with the second sponsor we have, it's not the first time you're really used to talking about balls, is it, on a podcast?
It's the first time I've had to talk about all balls. Which, is it me or is that not some sort of a tongue twister?
Yeah, it's a little difficult
to say. As you say it, it doesn't sound like... It sounds very forced. Doesn't roll off the tongue. All balls.
Yeah.
All balls.
All sorts of connotations as well.
Well, the good news is they're anyway, in for the whole year.
So
you can listen to me go back and forth on that all year long.
Well, you're stuttering away, but I bow to your commercial expertise in getting all these sponsors.
Well, you know, I do try hard. No, I actually had nothing to do with any of it.
Maybe you should explain to the listeners where we are, Lewis, because there's a strange soundtrack. It's a little bit windy. There's aeroplanes flying overhead, and there's also a massive fountain. So there's quite a bit of background noise on this podcast.
Yeah, we're in the hub, maybe, of motocross, Corona, California. You are here, not for Anaheim 2.
And not via a screen.
No.
I'm in person.
It's all changed. But you... people may listen to this and believe that you came for Anaheim 2 because you love Supercross. That's not the case.
No, that's not strictly true. I always try to get to one Supercross a year, and I was actually looking at Glendale, but it's been a crazy couple of weeks. I was in Austria for 3 days doing some work for a KTM magazine that's coming out this year for their 70th anniversary, as well as doing some stuff for the MotoGP team launches. And then straight to Ducati, of course, where they had their team launch, not only for MotoGP, but for World Superbike. And then the motocross project, it's not quite MXGP yet. I think that presentation will happen in 12 months' time when we find out who's actually going to be the factory riders. And then straight here for the Trackhouse MotoGP project that was launched on Friday in Hollywood. And it was perfect excuse to come and see you in Anaheim.
So this is it? You're not coming to another Supercross?
I don't think so, because there's just so many races going on now. I feel bad by, you know, being a bit loose with the MXGP schedule.
Okay, well, that's sad, but luckily we get to do this podcast in person.
Yes.
I've just noticed that our table is padlocked to the umbrella stand. I'm not sure if that's a comment on the area that we're in.
Yes. Well, it's the only table as well that seems to be padlocked.
I suddenly feel like we may get mugged, but, you know, we will persevere. You mentioned there that you went to Ducati's press launch,
yes.
Team launch. It's an annual event, happens for MotoGP every year. This was the... Does it? It does?
This was actually the second year where this very fanciful event that's run over 3 days takes place in a very exclusive Italian ski resort, not too far from Marco da Trento, where we have a very stable Grand Prix on the MXGP calendar. It used to be run in conjunction with the Ferrari Formula One team and Ducati, as they were both sponsored by Philip Morris, the tobacco sponsor, but it kind of went into hibernation for a few years, and in 2023 they resurrected it. And now for 2024, as we said, not only is it a celebration of Ducati winning both MotoGP and World Superbike for the second year in a row, but then also talking about their motocross program for the first time. And I think there was quite a lot of buzz online, Lewis, when the photographs of the bike first surfaced.
I felt like team launches were the norm in MotoGP, like Formula One.
They are.
Oh.
But, for example, some of them happen online. So maybe it's a 5 to 10 minute presentation, maybe followed by some Zoom interviews with the riders and team management. Or people like Ducati go in another direction, especially when they're reigning world champions and have something to actually show off. And I think also now with the motocross stuff, and it was very interesting because the motocross was at the end of the presentation that was online. But when it came to doing the press conference part afterwards, it was a full hour with Tony Cairoli, Alessandro Lupino, Davide Berni, I think his name is, who's the technical coordinator of the whole thing, basically the creator of the motorcycle. And then Paolo Ciabatti, who for 11 years was very much the man who pulled the strings in MotoGP and helped create Ducati into a bit of a powerhouse there, because Ducati are not only world champions in MotoGP, but they have their technology filling 8 of the 22 grid spots. So they really are, and I think in 2023 all 8 of those riders at least finish on the podium, and I think all of them at least won a sprint race or a Grand Prix race.
Was the press conference entertaining? I would imagine that some very uninformed questions were fielded.
No, actually, I mean, a lot of people curious about the technology, because of the Ducati's MotoGP bike is called a Desma Sedici, because it's, which I'm trying to make a fool of myself now with a translation from Italian, but it's based on the Desmatronic engine system, and the Dici part is a 16, so maybe that's something to do with the valve count, I don't know. But it, you know, this kind of very advanced proprietary technology is going to be applied to the motocross bikes, and I think there's a lot of people curious about that. So there were questions about it, and basically what will happen is the material that Ducati are using, they were very, very keen not to talk too much about it, because it's very experimental. In fact, the factory only have a couple of bikes. That's why when you've seen on social media Cairoli and Lupino doing riding shots maybe on something that looked like a Honda that was blacked out, that's because it was. They're still training and using other motorcycles when they're not doing official Ducati tests, just to, you know, keep up their rhythm or their sharpness or whatever.
I believe the coolest part about Ducati, or not the coolest part, but this is a nice indication of what's to come. For motocross to be involved in a press launch of that size, to carry so much wow factor, like that, this sport has never even touched or glanced in that kind of direction of professionalism, star power, And if that's what Ducati are going to bring, I'm very excited for that, because that should, in theory, make KTM, Kawasaki, Yamaha go, shit, we don't want to, but now we have to step up.
And there's two principal reasons for Ducati doing this project, which they explain in the press conference, and also you can deduce from their answers. One is basically to acquire some of the market share in off-road. Makes sense, doesn't it? And the second one is also to try and entice a younger demographic of motorcyclists who will then eventually think Ducati is a great brand. I love the bike. When I have $30,000 or euros or whatever, I might buy myself a Multistrada, a huge adventure bike, and then carry on being a Ducati customer. I mean, this is almost like an MO that many manufacturers have used for years. People that ride a Honda or use a Honda lawnmower, you know, they kind of tend to stick to the brand because if it's quality, then you're going to have trust. You're going to have some loyalty to that particular mark. So that's really where Ducati are coming from. I did think, sitting in the press conference, that the model seems slightly flawed, because if you're trying to get riders into off-road of a younger age, of a younger, say, profession, people that don't have $30,000 to spend on a motorcycle, then making a very premium 450 is not the right bike to have. But Paolo Ciabatti, the head of the project, confirmed, he couldn't let it slip, that they will be producing a 250 as well. And you imagine if they do have a 250 and a 450 like Triumph, then there will be other motorcycles popping up as well. Ducati also produce all the machinery for Moto E in MotoGP, so they have some headway when it comes to electric development as well. So it'd be mad for them not to be potentially considering minicycles to rival KTMs from that stuff.
I don't know why, but I struggle to believe that Ducati would make a 50, make a 65, make an 85. It would make sense for their business plan, but that just seems like such an investment into motocross.
Yeah.
That would almost, if they're going to go down that road, motocross would almost become bigger than anything else they're doing, because there would be so many different bikes, so many different uses of technology, so many different avenues to consider, different ages, blah, blah, blah. I would be surprised to see them go down that path.
Yeah, I mean, they're a manufacturer that are selling 60 to 70,000 motorcycles. I mean, they're way behind KTM in terms of being the largest manufacturer in Europe. But they do have a lot of clout when it comes to style, image, marketing, presentation. I mean, think of some of the iconic films. I mean, things like Tron Legacy or The Matrix, just to reel off a couple. I mean, the Ducati is a brand that's sort of synonymous with pop culture, dare I say. I know we don't talk too much about that, Lewis, in your
case. I'm just smiling and waving.
Just nod all away, yeah. Okay. It's kind of ironic that you're sitting behind a Kung Fu Panda 4 picture on the cinema.
I didn't know there was a Kung Fu Panda 4.
There we go.
Or 3 or 2.
So, back to your point, what you mentioned earlier, I think when Ducati go racing, we might see some very interesting ways in which they're talking about it and they're using it. I think it will be almost like a flagship kind of thing. And it's a very expensive way to market yourself and to go racing if you're not going to be selling vast amounts of motorcycles. But, you know, that seems to be their way.
It's a shame, really, that Triumph and Ducati have almost entered at effectively the same time, because I do feel as though the Ducati has stolen the limelight. I feel like Ducati is now the new shiny toy that we all are kind of pulled to, and Triumph has already fallen into the position of just another manufacturer that's been around. Oh, they've been around. We know Triumph, even though they haven't raced yet.
It's the exclusiveness factor. I think the Desmo 450 MX is going to be probably one of the most expensive dirt bikes on the market. It looks fantastic. It's still a prototype, so it's probably going to change quite a bit, and certainly when it comes to the engineering, but they're using premium components. And, you know, I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, and when we're in the car and a Ferrari zooms by on the road, they're like, whoa, look at that. You know, that wow factor, I think, will be the same thing. I think, will the dirt bike community really have their sort of socks blown off by a fanciful Italian-looking motorcycle? I don't know, but that's the effect that they're going for. You know, when you see a Ducati on the track, you might be thinking, wow, you know, everyone's going to want to check it out and look at it. That's the kind of impact they're looking for.
There was more crossover with the MotoGP sponsors appearing on the motocross bike. I don't know if that was just a placeholder, or if brands like Lenovo have a genuine interest in backing this motocross project.
Yeah, Flexbox or something. That's another MotoGP.
Was that what project. Was what was on the handlebars? Was that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it's Lenovo, because that's their total sponsors of the MotoGP team. I don't think they have anything to do with Superbike, but Monster Energy, of course, are across all three teams now, whereas before they were just in MotoGP. Now they're into Superbike this year, and they'll also be, as we saw on the MXGP thing. But Chiabatti, one of his briefs is to try and drum up budget and sponsors and cash to go racing, because, as he admitted, to be part of AMA Supercross in 2026 is going to be a hefty wedge of cash, and they're going to need the riders. So that has to come from somewhere.
It will be a shame. Like, obviously, their first port of call will be to contact their existing sponsors and see if they can find budget. So if they eventually go racing with just motocross brands as sponsors, that kind of will be a very telltale sign that our sport isn't exactly attractive to these brands, which would be a shame. But if there's one motorcycle manufacturer that can widen our reach and introduce new brands, it's Ducati.
Yeah, just because of that wider consciousness about it. But then again, maybe there will be a cagey kind of approach to them. You know, people want to see if the bike is competitive. It's a bit of if it fails, you know, what rider is also going to be associated with it. If you have Ken Roczen as the first Ducati rider in AMA Supercross, that's a big, big deal.
What do you think they're going to do rider-wise? Because I struggle to understand. My personal opinion is that Ducati will go racing with the very best riders. They won't enter MXGP with two top 15 riders and build from there. They are going to want to make a splash.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be throwing silly money at it. I think they'll have a good budget, especially to get the whole thing rolling. But Alessandro Lupino, you know, is a guy who's ridden for at least five other brands. He brings that experience. He's not old. I think he's like 29, maybe just on the edge of his 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's safe to say that he's going to be carrying the project into MXGP in 2025 because of his development experience he'll be doing in the 4-5 round Italian championship this year. Cairoli in the press conference pretty much said, look, I've been out of GP racing, top flight racing for 2 years now. He was very not forthcoming in saying he would be keen to do an MXGP appearance,
yeah,
which we assumed he would.
Yeah.
Maybe he could do a couple of demo laps at Majora. I think that's, you know, not beyond the realms of possibility, but I don't think we'll see a 222 running in a race, you know, with that machine.
Not even the Italian championship. Was there any
possibly
mention of that?
But he won't be. I can't see him popping up at a Grand Prix unless it's just in a token gesture. I can't see him being in the gate wanting to go. I mean, he's going to have no interest in presenting a new project with that kind of visibility and spotlight and then being 15th.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's unhealthy for Ducati, because although we know that the bike may not be ready and it's a prototype and they're building, seeing Cairoli in 15th, is your mind will automatically go, that's a failure.
That's why if he did three laps, pulled some cool whips, gave people plenty of material to do videos and photos or whatever, then that's a great thing. I mean, if I was Ducati, I'd already be penciling that in for the Italian rounds. And we've got plenty of Italian GPs on the calendar this year to do it.
So what do you think happens next? Do you think they go away and become quite quiet for the next year? Or do you feel like, will there be big, another like launch type thing around the first race? Will this be a continuous marketing scheme?
Yeah, I can't see there being like press releases after every Italian championship round. I mean, maybe if Lupino goes out and takes a victory, then for sure, you know, maybe some social media material. But as Chiabatti himself said in the press conference, we're only a couple of months away from them having to confirm a rider lineup for 2025. We can speculate which rider is going to be in there. If you have Lupino, as we said, a rider who's not the youngest but does have the experience, then what kind of rider do they look for to really push for potentially results? The mind boggles.
Well, let's play this game. So, I probably should have done some research. Roman is definitely out of contract.
But you'd think he'd be riding a Triumph, right? And back
heard
to his old team.
I heard that the Triumph 450 is massively behind. And there are question marks about 2025.
That makes sense, because, I mean, you were mentioned earlier about Triumph and Ducati being at the same time, but Triumph are well ahead.
I don't know. Because I've had this conversation with Kellen, I think. The perception is that Triumph are way ahead, but Ducati have been riding a bike or this technology for 2 years, which is about the same sort of time as Triumph.
Yeah, but Triumph are like a month and a bit away from making their Grand Prix debut. I mean, Ducati are well off that. Pre-season races are going to start soon as well. I mean, Carmichael, DeSalle, they've been doing a long, long testing phase. I think Ducati only had a rolling prototype at the end of 22. So, yeah, I would say they're ahead.
But not by much? A year, maybe? Certainly not more than a year.
Who knows? But let's see the competitiveness of it. But if the 450 is behind schedule, then maybe it will come too late for Febra.
Did you see... before, put a pin in that, back to the rider. So, yeah, Roman is out of contract at the end of this year. Would not be surprised to see him on a Triumph or a Ducati with a massive paycheck. Sewer is under contract. Herlings is under contract. Tim is under contract. Prado will come to a...
Geiger, I think it's his last year this year, isn't it?
Who knows? HRC love the multi-year deal.
Yeah.
But he's not going to leave Honda.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Yes?
No, I mean...
Because he's not in those twilight years yet where he would consider such a...
This is actually
project.
His 10th season, I think, in Honda Colors, if you combine MX2 as well. So it's a long association. I mean, Herlings is starting his 15th season as a Red Bull KTM rider. That's the longest, you know, factory rider association for quite some time in anywhere. But then Geiger is catching up.
100%, either Ducati or Triumph will put a massive offer to Herlings for 2026. And... like, I would bet so much money on that, because you would, as a business, what is wrong with me today? Hold on. Hard reset. Here we go. As a businessman, you would put that offer out there just to see. You would kind of presume that it's not going to happen, but you would be interested. Let me see if this offer tempts him. Like, you know, it's just a good lesson, isn't it? So it'd be very interesting to see if Herlings is tempted.
Who else could move up? I mean, you'd say a rider like Calvin Verlandren, you could probably get much cheaper than you would Jeffrey Herlings.
But he could still earn more than he could anywhere else.
What would Ducati's goals be for their first season? Would it be to try and make an impact, or would it be to try and chase victory straight away with a rider that you would assume would be in championship contention? That's another thing.
For some reason, I had it in my mind that a lot more contracts were up at the end of this year, but I guess not. Roman.
This is a part where we need to have a list in front of us and we can run down. But we know Prado, of course, but that's too early for Ducati. I assume that he's going to be over here.
Ducati over here? Here being America?
26, yeah. The earliest.
If it was 2025, I wouldn't be surprised.
But like I said a minute ago, these contracts will be discussed in the next couple of months, even though it won't happen until a year later. There's no way Jorge Prado at 23 years old is going to take an unproven bike and an unproven project.
I hear that his agent likes money.
What agent doesn't?
That's true. That is kind of the agent's MO. Speaking of Triumph, did you see their team launch for the American Supercross team?
No. But apparently it was quite poor.
Well, settle down. Here we go. So Triumph did a really good job with their MXGP launch. They had all of us there at the Nations, the biggest event of the year. They had Triumph's CFO? CTO? COO?
Steve Sargent. I can't remember what his
Chief
exact...
Technical Officer? CTO?
Perhaps.
Yeah,
CPO?
I believe so.
Chief Product Officer?
C something O. They had the bike, race livery, all of the sponsors in the correct place. Really nicely put together.
Don't forget the most vital ingredient. That was DeSalle for the first time talking about it. And Clement's always, you know, interesting to listen to because he doesn't mince his words.
So it went up. The stock of Triumph went up at that point. We were all like, brilliant. This is lovely. Fast forward 5 months later, they announced their American team. I mean, I would
amateur
presume...
Hour?
Amateur Hour doesn't even cover it. What's below amateur? Novice Hour?
But that's surprising with the people we know that are behind it.
One pixelated photo, I suspect, was shot on an iPhone because there's no way that was shot on a real camera, because I'm not a photographer. If I was given a real camera, I could do a better photo than that. No riding photos, just them sat. There wasn't even a big team around them. It was like the rider and one personnel per rider. But if I'm Triumph, I want to scream about the personnel involved and how big this team is and how big this commitment is. Even more baffling, or most baffling, is that all of their lead up to the bike unveil involved exclusively the American team. Exclusively Bobby Hewitt, exclusively Carmichael. Those videos didn't include anyone from the MXGP side. So I have no idea what went on there, but that's a good way to fumble some whatever momentum you had.
So it's clearly a lack of organisation. I mean, mistakes can be made with photos or whatever, but then you obviously follow that up, you chase sources, you kind of plug your network to make sure that the message is right. And like you say, if the message is not good from the off, then it shows a flaw or a shortcoming somewhere.
Yeah, I was really disappointed.
I don't think Ducati will do the same thing, but let's see what Triumph are capable of and where the motorcycle is.
I know that, well, naturally, this weekend in Detroit is their first competitive motocross supercross race. I know that a lot of Triumph bigwigs will be in town. So I may actually try and do a little round table where I'll just be like, I'm not here to talk about the bike. Let's talk about the PR.
You can say, it's good to see you. I'm glad you're not all pixelated.
That would be something. That would be what I would do. No, I might actually try and talk to them because I'd be interested to know their opinion. Because there's no, if I'm Triumph, I am a little pissed that Ducati has essentially pissed on my parade. Because when they committed to this, they wouldn't have known that Ducati was coming.
Who knows what kind of whispers going on in the industry? But yeah, more people are talking about Ducati now. Is that because they basically jumped on the back of the MotoGP presentation?
I think
so. Maybe there's something to do with it. But like you say, if Triumph haven't got their shit together, and we don't know internally how the bikes are developing, how they're competitive, whether the riders are happy, there's not really many messages coming out. But, you know, the team they're using in MXGP especially, extremely professional and extremely competent. Let's not forget, they came within a couple of points of winning the MXGP World Championship the last time they were active in 2021. I think Triumph has to be on the way.
I hear that the Triumph chassis is really, really good. I hear that the engine maybe isn't the most competitive as far as top speed, but that's kind of made okay by the fact that the chassis is just so good. But yeah, it kind of counterbalances.
Are we going to be in a situation in MXGP for the first time in a while where there are actually more factory saddles and promising teams than there are elite level riders to kind of take profit of them?
Oh, no doubt. Think about, we just talked about Ducati's riders and we were throwing out Calvin Vlaander in as like a number one option or a great option. For Ducati, we should be talking about only multi-time world champions. Again, that's my perception of the brand. And kudos to them, because if I, who has paid very little attention to what Ducati has done up until this point, have that preconceived notion of a brand, then clearly they've done a good job of their messaging and whatever else. Because if that's what I'm thinking, then yeah, they've effectively hit the mainstream with a good message.
Well, maybe just talking about this, we can seek a little bit into Jorge Prado and his the culmination of his AMA Supercross adventure. But MXGP is facing a transition period where you think, well, you know, where is the next cream of the crop coming from?
It's worrying. It's really worrying.
Sui, you would have to imagine 2 to 3 years, Febra, less. Hurlings, the same.
Yep.
In less than 5 years' time, you're going to have a complete recycle of MXGP.
You will have, yeah, say 4 years' time, you will have Tim in his twilight years, Renault, Gertz.
Maybe we're just looking at people like Alberto Ferrato. Oh, you're boy. Looking at the younger...
Well, Ben Watson.
Yeah, he's getting on a bit as well, isn't he? If he was like 21, I would say, yeah, okay.
He's not getting on. Come on, that's ridiculous.
We're talking 4 years' time, Lewis.
The day that Ben Watson retires, I'm going to do like a march down a street with flags and like it's going to be a whole ceremony.
Well, he's ridden a couple of bikes now. I mean, he's been on a Kawasaki, he's been on a Yamaha, he's been on a Beta.
He's really good friends with Lupino.
There you go. Ducati rider.
Let's put some work into this, actually, you know? Let's
Giovanni's going to be coming to a race soon. Maybe you should, you know, sort of rub shoulders with him, give him a few suggestions.
Yeah, I think we'll have a separate meeting about that after this podcast.
Wear a Sherlock Holmes costume and start talking in strange language to him. Keep calling him Watson.
What my biggest fear all along, what if Ducati only want to associate themselves with Italians?
It's possible, but then I think Lupino fills that role for them. And like I said, he's bringing continuity because he's ridden the prototype, he'll be going through the racing appearances, and he'll go into MXGP. Unless, of course, there's a mad kind of swing around in the riders market and they have the opportunity to sign somebody, you know, quite decent for decent money.
Jonas.
Maxime Renault, just going back to our previous subject, is the rider, maybe along with Geiger. Those two are really going to be taking MXGP into the next sort of era.
I feel like Jonas would be really good for them. Former world champion, knowledge of how KTM works, knowledge of now a Japanese bike, still got top end speed.
Yeah, Paul just needs to get through the whole season and really sort of bank that top five championship finish. That has to be his objective.
I like Paul's.
Good team, good bike this year. This is like 2024 is his season to really bank some results.
So, theoretically, let's say that Prado gets offered a Supercross deal for $600,000, which I feel is around roughly what he's worth in America. Say Ducati offer him 1.5 million euros to stay in MXGP and be the face of Ducati.
At the age of 24, I don't see it.
What, as in you think he would follow his heart and come to America?
100%, yeah. I mean, I know it's a lot of money, but I think he would give America a go. And I don't think his stock could really fall that much because he will still be a three-time world champion when he comes back to Europe. I think he could still command. I mean, let's take a rider's career. The next minimum two contracts, at least three for Jorge Prado, are going to be the kind of money and the kind of level where he'll want to, you know, create income to last him the rest of his life.
What do you make of Prado's American adventure? It's over now?
We're talking about this yesterday in the press box in Anaheim, and I think regardless of the results, you have to give him eternal credit for having a go. And I think it's awesome that the MXGP world champion is out in the premier class trying a triple crown. And I was rolling my eyes at the start of the Supercross season when the usual bollocks comes up about everything being so stacked and the field is so deep. It just seems to be the echo of every preseason hype. But looking at the field yesterday and you see Eli Tomac running around in the depths of the top 10, you kind of think, well, Jorge really had, he was on a hide into nothing in terms of the results. But, you know, he almost hole shotted twice. I mean, it was, he displayed that starting prowess that we all knew he's capable of. And I think he just completely and utterly got his feet wet. And imagine Chase Sexton came over and did the final four rounds of MXGP. Regardless of what he did, the fact that he's there and we could talk to him and he's shown an interest in another series, I think is something you just have to credit him for.
Yeah, it is funny. I feel like in reverse, if Sexton came over to do a period in MXGP, I feel like there would almost be more attention on it purely because it's an American going somewhere versus a European coming somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think that's just the way this sport is. And actually, talking about, I wanted to ask you this about Ducati, just to quickly go back. Is this sport, and I only recently stumbled upon this way of thinking, is this sport inherently flawed because we have MXGP and the American? So for Ducati, who have always been like, okay, we need to do the MotoGP World Championship, they're like, so we have to race two series. Why?
I think it works out well for them. Like, for example, when I've done the Ducati factory tour, you go through the engine department and they have two lines. One that's made with a European kind of spec for the engine, and then one for the US. There's a clear distinction between the markets that they're aiming for. Those are the two big markets that their business interests are centered on. So therefore, being able to concentrate on Supercross in North America and then concentrate on the rest of the world to take their dirt bike projects to the depths of Indonesia for 2 weeks, I think it's something that ticks both boxes quite easily.
But from a budget standpoint, they could save a lot of money if they just had to focus on the motocross championship, whatever one that is.
Yeah, but by the same token, they could do a factory edition like KTM do, minimum production run, and enter Supercross relatively quickly with a production base, and then concentrate on developing and maybe pushing the envelope with what they want to do in GPs on the other side. I think it works out well.
I just would imagine that it would deter Ducati in their meetings when they're like, okay, I'm Mr. Ducati, I don't know anything about this sport that we're going into, so what is the championship? And they're like, oh, you're going to love this. There's two that we have to do. But, and we can't slack on either one because they're both of equal importance. Imagine if, okay, put it this way. MotoGP 2, MotoGP the sequel, comes out for this year. Ducati suddenly have to replicate all resources and put equal effort into another MotoGP series.
Yeah.
There would be a lot of complaints.
Of course. But then Supercross, Ducati for the last 2 years, and maybe the last five in terms of their engineering, have conquered the most watched motorcycle racing series in the world. Almost 3 million people were at the circuit fences alone in 2023 watching MotoGP. So therefore, the second biggest one is going to be AMA Supercross. So why not aim for that? So if Ducati aiming for MotoGP and Supercross, then again, it all makes sense.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Do you think that Prado's Supercross experience will hinder him come MXGP?
He's got testing to do as soon as he gets back. I mean, there's no coincidence that he's done Anaheim 2 and is flying out straight away. He's not hanging around anymore. I think he's got time to do it. And it's not as if he's going to face a few GPs where he doesn't know the tracks, or, you know, compared to the Supercross experience, he's going to be like putting on an old pair of slippers.
And to be fair, Prado's MO is he will win this championship on consistency, being there every week. His MO is an operate at the very, very maximum of what he's capable week after week. So maybe starting slow actually plays into his strategy perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be looking for the same kind of results that he did last year, where he won two GPs, but he won quite a few motos. If Herlings rips off a sequence by winning the first three or four GPs, but Jorge's second every week, then he's just staying in the battle. I think, you know, that's something that he's going to be looking at. And let's not forget, if he is looking at Supercross of 2025, again, that's a discussion that's going to be happening in the next few months. So then everything will become clearer and he can just go into the rest of the season, you know, with the right approach.
My
isn't he linked with Kawasaki already?
Well, my sources tell me, not ketchup or mayonnaise, other sources tell me that
Bernays,
yes, God, now it's out there. tell me that there's a very, very, very high chance that he is not on an Austrian bike come 2025.
So he's Jason Anderson's teammate then, replaces him.
Well, I don't know. What the options would be apart from Austria, but my thinking is Jason Anderson's teammate makes sense, or if Tomac retires, Yamaha could have Cooper Webb to win Supercross and then Prado to win outdoors, and it's kind of a nice balance. I would hazard a guess that Monster would be willing to pay a lot to steal Prado.
Yeah, he's been Red Bull forever. I mean, he was even wearing the cap of the, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's where Red Bull, they're that young, they're not allowed to wear kind of an energy drink cap, it's something else. I remember him doing that when he was like 12 going into European Championship. So for him to split from that company after a decade is pretty big.
Yeah, like think
like
about
Tony Cairoli wearing a Monster cap.
Yeah, and no, so we first heard about Cairoli going to Monster in November, and I felt like it was a massive deal. I felt like you were equally shocked.
Yeah,
it came out, no one mentioned it. No one cares, and I can't believe it, because I said this to you in November. I almost feel like Cairoli ditching Red Bull for Monster is a bigger deal than him ditching KTM for Ducati.
But maybe it's almost like a Dungey affair where he suddenly breaks away from KTM, goes to Honda, is wearing a different cap, different colours, and then ends up drifting back towards KTM and Red Bull. Maybe it's a similar thing where, okay, Cairoli's wearing a Monster cap, big deal, but there's that depth of association. I think Cairoli was wearing a Red Bull cap as early as 2004. So, I mean, that's almost 20 years being associated. He was initially had a deal for Red Bull Italy, and I think it was only for the chin bar of the helmet. So it was one of those real kind of minor deals. But Cairoli is the only motocross guy I've seen, certainly in Europe, on the side of a can in a supermarket. I mean, he was a big deal with Red Bull. So it is a big thing.
Not sure if we should say this or if I've said it on here before, but Prado did ride a Kawasaki last year. So,
well, you assume he was testing other bikes if he's before he signed a contract extension.
But he definitely rode a Kawasaki. So there's form there with green manufacture.
My first thought was, if he's going to come to Supercross and really make that move, I know he's extremely happy. His family have been with him out here in California, his parents, that he would want to do so in relatively comfortable climbs of knowing the Austrian setup, the Pira Mobility Group, everything around it, whether it's GasGas or Husqvarna or KTM, that would seem the easiest way. But then, like you were saying earlier, if he has a deal with Kawasaki where they're prepared to pay $1 million, plus he has X amount from Monster, and then maybe Austria saying, listen, you know, we're going to give you a conservative contract while you sort of, you know, you learn, you do your Supercross education, then maybe that's the difference.
And the Prado-Austria relationship has been difficult at times. I'm not sure that it's ever been smooth sailing. But to that point, and I don't know how to say this without making it sound like a issue or negative, Prado is, I believe, maybe slightly difficult to have on a team. I think he's quite headstrong, and I think he knows what he wants.
He's an A-list rider, so he's going to be demanding. I don't think he's going to pander to anybody else. I mean, as soon as he came in the factory team, there was that he was on the billing with Herlings and Cairoli, and that is going to create friction.
Yeah, and when I look at the options in America, I feel as though not one of the teams would really fit him perfectly. So I almost don't know what he should do.
Well, that's also going to be part of his mental adjustment, isn't it? Because not only is he going to have to change country, change lifestyle, change series, but then also change his expectations and the parameters of what he knows a factory team is. I mean, Prado is one of the best 250 riders I've ever seen, but he made that jump straight into the premier class and riding a 450, and again deserves credit for racing AMA 450 SX. But yeah, I think you're right, Lewis. He has a particular kind of character. But, you know, it's going to be a test of his flexibility.
Yeah, and to your point, they all do. All of these A-list athletes have a little quirk and are difficult in some ways. There are hurling stories.
Do you think people have looked at Prado's results? I mean, he won a heat race, obviously, in diabolical conditions. Do you think they've looked at him and thought, well, what's all the fuss about? You know, maybe did people expect a bit more?
Fans or industry?
Yeah, everybody. This was what's the kind of consensus?
I would hope not, because I really do not believe that you could ask for much more, especially in this field, as you said. There's absolutely no way you could ask for more. Would more have been nice? Sure. But like, he passed Jet back last night, he passed Roxen back last night. Just those little two-second moments are proof of his capabilities and just how much potential he has in Supercross. Those mean more than his results. And I said that to him after the race. My favourite quote that I got from him after the race was, "I got absolutely smoked and I loved every single second of it."
Decent quote. I watching him was an education, because you could see the chinks in the armour. I didn't think his corner speed was that sharp compared to the others. He rode really well defensively. When he got into a position, he was holding off people, but then he was also kind of holding them up a little bit. I thought he showed considerable smarts, considering his very short Supercross education, and his starts were just phenomenal. I mean, if you always have that sort of weapon in your arsenal, then one day is going to count. And lucky he did make it count in the mud.
Yeah, and that was a big moment for him. I think even though that was the mud, I do believe that was some confirmation that he can do this. And everyone needs that in every walk of life. We all deal with self-doubt, and we'll take any sort of positive reinforcement, whatever way we can get it.
Except for you, Lewis. You're a monolith of motocross media.
What does that mean?
Just a big structure that nobody can move.
Honestly, I've got serious issues. I don't know how much longer I can deal with my issues. No, but he will be here next year. You would bet everything you have on it, as would I.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
if Prado's in MXGP in 2025, I will walk up to him and be like, "What happened? How? Why?"
Then there are other possibilities. Maybe somebody says to him, "We will give you 3 years in the US, but first do a year for us in Europe."
Ducati, 1 year in MXGP and then America.
Yeah, but it's not proven enough. And Jorge, at this stage in his career, if he was 27, 28, take it. But at 23 years old, no.
Okay, to come full circle, the Roxen Ducati rumours have existed for some time. Have you actually spoken to anyone at Ducati about this?
No. Because it's still too early. You know, even Chiabatti was admitting in the press conference that, you know, they need to confirm the team, they need to confirm the riders for Supercross in 25 in the first 6 months of this year. But then they also need to sort of solidify their MXGP team. So I think too much is in the air.
Could you see any sort of possibility that Roxen does 2025 MXGP and then goes back to America in 2026?
I would say no. Just because he has a very young family, and I think taking them on the road around Europe might be a, a stretch too far.
But when there were rumours about him wanting to do MXGP again, the reason was I want to show my family what I once did.
Yeah, but I think having two small kids compared to one is a different thing.
Yeah, I forgot he's got another one now.
So I don't know what his feelings are with Hep and Suzuki, but like perhaps Febro or a rider that's in a prime position coming to the end of a contract cycle, it's natural that Roczen, I think, and also he's still so competitive. You know, I think it's natural people are going to be linking him everywhere. But coming back to AMA Supercross, where could he feasibly go here? So Ducati would be a logical step, especially with a big fat contract.
Yeah, sign a one-year extension with Suzuki and then go to Ducati. I just wonder if he'll still be around in 2026.
Yeah.
Because he is getting on, sad as it is to say.
As long as he's fast enough, I think it's like the Chad Reed thing, you know, as long as he's competitive enough, then there's still a motivation or a means, there's a sort of an enthusiasm to discover the means to keep racing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time for the sport.
Like, I have a big question for you, cutting right across you. Will you go to Argentina?
I don't know.
But you're considering it, right?
I'm considering it. Part of me feels like I should, but then part of me feels like I shouldn't. It would be cool.
Why shouldn't you?
Because do I not need to commit myself to this Supercross gig?
Is it a weekend off that weekend?
No.
Oh, okay.
And it's a new venue.
Right.
But I don't really feel like it's all sterile stadiums.
Yeah.
Do I really need to see the new stadium? I don't know. It's in Alabama. Do I need to go to Alabama? I don't know.
Maybe it's more of a market thing. You know, how do the fans in that area respond to Supercross?
Yeah, so I don't know. Should I see that?
There's been that much doubt around the Argentinian Grand Prix in motocross that you have to wonder what kind of crowd are going to be there.
Yeah, because they only started selling tickets Friday, which is 5 weeks, six weeks before the event.
And if MotoGP is off and Superbike is off, how kind of fluid is the event going to be in terms of financial backing and people making a go of it when we're only, what, a month away? Just over a month.
Yeah, you've got to reckon that this is the end. This is the last Argentine GP.
Well, it just seems so volatile in terms of political landscape and funding and whatever else. I mean, it's not the most stable economy in the world. So great fans, such passion for motorcycle racing. But and Neuquén is a magical place with a very curious track with that sort of volcanic ash. But having it for the first Grand Prix as well, maybe those days are numbered.
If I can get a travel buddy, I'll go.
Okay. It can't be that far to fly down. I mean, we've seen American guests and riders popping up there in the past.
Yeah, and I was sent flights, business class, from Orlando to Buenos Aires, $700.
Perfect. Do it. Business class as well.
I do like... Well, I've never been in business class, but I do like the sound of business class.
It's not exactly a big time zone stretch either, so there you go.
No, maybe I should. But if I do it, I'd want to, like, make a bit of a splash.
I expect to see you there. After all this talk.
Well, how are you going to see me if you're not going
to
be there?
I expect to see you there through the powers of imagery and video from the circuit.
Who's your pick for the MXGP title?
Oh, that's just throw that one straight in there.
You asked me a question, I'll ask you a question.
Are we on a clock? I want to say between Prado and Renault with a big splash of Herling's contribution to the results. Well, you just asked, you know, that's the first sort of thoughts that come to mind.
Okay. May I interest you in a Geyser or a Fevre or a Sewer?
It's just a ridiculous answer. I mean, Fevre is going to be competitive. Sewer, big question mark. Quality rider, but he's going to gel with a bike. And Geyser, you know, maybe if it's his last year in HRC and things are not going well, maybe he needs to mix things up.
Sewer needs time.
You think?
Sewer needs time.
Right. So he's not going to be such a happy bunny doing interviews, you think, for a while?
Well, I don't know, because Argentina is still a while away.
Everyone's going to be saying to him, how's the new bike? How are you feeling? He's going to be sick of answering those questions.
We need some time.
He's the most interesting rider, right, this year, in terms of the changes and the potential?
Yeah, and especially because such a fuss was kicked up about the Yamaha fallout. He really dug his heels in and demanded a move to Kawasaki. So if this doesn't pay off in results or happiness or whatever medium you want to use, then I do believe that eyebrows will be raised and maybe his stock will drop. Not only stock as an athlete, but maybe his word won't carry as much weight.
But he was great on a Suzuki. He was great on a Yamaha. If it doesn't work out with Kawasaki, then it's not as if people are going to look at him thinking, well, there's a rider who can't, you know, move to another package.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know, Sua's, when we look back on Sua's career, it will be an odd one to, like, reflect on.
Yeah, but there's no other rider with a consistency in the appearances. I mean, his CV is immaculate, isn't it? Apart from missing, you know, a gold number plate.
Yeah, I guess it depends, like, what you want to focus on, doesn't it?
Right, for me, it's just the staying ability. When people get... He's the contrast to Geoffrey Herlings.
Well...
What about you? Who do you think is going to win? Nah, see, it's not so easy, is it?
You've got a bet on Herlings. You just have to.
I don't know. I mean, that's what I said to you before. I think, you know, there's a big question mark over Jeremy and whether he's going to do on a KX450F. But also Herlings as well, because he's gone balls to the wall. He's won races at a canter because he's so fast. But then also he's just got hurt. You know, he's come off the bike once, broken something and disappeared for 2 to 3 rounds. At least, and then that's just thrown his championship to the weeds.
Most likely is that Tim wins the championship in a very Tim manner, which is turn up every week, not much flash, take advantage of others' mistakes, and just be there to the end, and then, wow, you're the champion with a 100-point lead.
That broken femur last year was a real kind of road bump in his career, because the excellence has been that high for that long. You know, when you ask me about championship contenders, momentarily didn't even loom into view, but we can't forget how much he's won. I mean, he's going to be good.
When I was on the Pulp Show last week, I felt vindicated because Prado mentioned without prompt, I can't even remember what he said now. He said, the focus is to beat Geoffrey always. He said, I dreamt of beating Geoffrey, which confirms finally that what everyone has been saying is correct, and that Geoffrey is the pinnacle. That for even for his peers, Geoffrey is a standard that no one else is at, and to beat him means a lot more than it does to beat Tim.
In one way. I mean, I heard that as well on the Pulp Show, and I thought yes, but then I mean, Herlings is a barometer for speed, without doubt. But then, you know, I think you have to look at the kind of consistency that Geiger's maintained since 2016, and he came into the class, and think that also has to be a reference. And if it's not, then you're an idiot.
Well, I feel like I'm very much alone on Herlings Island. I feel like people are swimming away.
Herlings has said it himself. You know, he has all those victories, and he said I should have more than 5 world titles. Although, you know, Steve Mathis, our friend and colleague, saying in the press box yesterday that his MX2 wins don't count, because they have this bizarre thing in the US where they don't want to count victories from another class. I wanted to explain to him, if you win the Grand Prix of France, you've won the biggest annual race of the year in that particular country, and that counts for something.
Yeah, and an MX2 GP is not comparable to a regional Supercross series.
Exactly. Yeah, or even a national.
No. Same bikes, that's it. Stops there. This is to continue a debate in the press box. Everyone likes to give Geoffrey shit because Roczen came to America, Marvin came to America, and so he was kind of left alone as the shining star. When Caroli went to 450s, Tommy came to America, Tyler came to America. Now, there you go, even more examples. Recency bias makes you not put much stock in that because Tommy's 450 career wasn't that great, so you kind of forget how good he was. Tyler kind of petered off as his career went on, so you forget that 05, 06, 07, 08, he was the man. Like, he came into every season. He was very Geoffrey-esque. He came into every season with, if he stays healthy, he'll win.
Yeah.
And he failed to stay healthy more often than not.
Well, 2005, he broke his knee when he should have won the World Championship.
What was the year that he came... He won the first round, got injured, came back for the last 3 rounds and won all of them. And it was like, okay, he's the best guy, but he just didn't get it done.
He was still winning Grand Prix, I think, 2004-05 on a 125. And then when he finally got on the 250, he was set for the championship, then did his knee, I think in Namur, in Belgium, and that was that.
Yeah, because that was round 4 in 2005.
Yeah.
So that would make sense.
Won the championship after a sort of to the wire dice with Tommy Searle, Red Bull KTM colours, and surprisingly jumped ship, went straight to Pro Circuit, which, you know, in the end you can't really blame him for, and if that opportunity comes around. But can I deviate from Roman and ask you another question?
Sure.
One other big thing we have to watch out for in MXGP this year is the other factory Yamaha rider. What does Yago do? Look at that. I wish people could see your facial expression right now.
I don't know. Hire a new social media representative.
Is he going to win a Grand Prix?
No.
He's not going to win a Grand Prix. I think he could.
Yago's going to beat Fevre, Prado, Herlings, Sewer, Geyser to a Grand Prix win.
At some point when two to three of them perhaps aren't there for some reason.
Okay, but that's a different conversation.
It was still a Grand Prix win.
That's fair. I believe that he will be a solid third to sixth place rider. And that'll be fine.
It has to be on a factory Yamaha.
Yeah, anything below that is not acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, if he is... I mean, look, Ben Watson was cut for being... sorry, Lewis. I mean, he was cut for being a top 10 regular guy. I mean, there were a couple of alarming GPs, like in Turkey, where he just, you know, was barely in the points. But then there was also some really good appearances. So I think Gertz has to use that. Maybe there's some push from behind him, the likes of Thibaut Benestan as well. I mean, if he was staying in MSGP, he might be angling for a 450 ride as well. I don't know if you guys has 1 or 2 years.
No, it's a multi-year.
Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah.
You'd be an idiot just doing 1 year as a rookie.
But although, now that we say that, why do I have a feeling that it might be 1 year?
I think it was a two. It was like one more year MX2 plus the first year in MSGP. But there must be an option to extend that. Imagine he has a Roman Febre type, you know, rookie season.
And I don't believe that is out of the question.
No.
If the cards have to fall, as they did for Roman...
I think he'll be good on a 450, but he's one of these riders where he just seems to carry around bizarre injuries as well. And you never really know about them until the last minute. And that sort
Well,
of
that's odd,
effect.
Because his PR representative is doing such a good job. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like he'll be good. He'll be quiet. It's Yago. He won't demand much attention. He'll be quietly effective. And then, yeah, when people get injured, he'll be there and we'll be like, oh, Yago is third in the points. What a surprise.
There's also that kind of top five, top eight group as well. That'll be quite interesting. I'm talking about Ferrato. I'm talking about Jonas. I'm talking about Coldenhoff, Guadagnini. You know, Van der Muschite, you know, where does he fit in as well?
Watson.
Well, sorry, Ben as well.
I have a sneaky suspicion that Coldenhoff could be rejuvenated on a Fantic.
Yeah, or is the Fantic going to be any good?
It's a Yamaha.
Yeah, you know what I mean. It's slightly different.
I got told that the factory parts have Yamaha printed on them. Like, they are getting the same factory parts from Yamaha Japan as they did when they were a Yamaha team.
Right. And it's Louis Voster's team still. So
still KYB, yep. Still, like,
Technical support as well. I mean, if the bike is not working, will they get upgrades? Will they have that kind of resource and support?
How do I, as a journalist, go about really getting into the finer details of the Yamaha Fantic partnership?
Well, Yamaha don't like you, so you're going to be missing that part.
No, that is an issue.
So you could sort of operate slightly on the Fantic side and get that side of it.
I would hope that it'd be a very one-sided story.
Fantic and the Blue.
I would hope that Yamaha now like me. Time has gone on. Wounds have healed. I've not really done anything wrong in a long time.
And, you know, out of... What's the phrase? Out of sight, out of mind.
Yep.
You haven't been there for a while.
I do feel a little bit forgotten.
Yeah, but the series has been on ice. It's the off-season. Everything's been forgotten.
There's not been a memorial moment for me. Or I don't know. Just maybe I do need to go to Argentina.
For MSGB to go back to NA and they'll have a strike in your honour.
Who was... That was on Pulp as well, when Prado mentioned a strike and Steve went, yeah, because of Lewis. I was like, oh no, that's not good. That's not good. to loop this back around, finishing point. Do you believe that Ducati understand what this sport is? And do you believe that we could end up in a point where they are disenchanted with the fact that, oh, an MXGP press conference has two people in it? Oh, we're in Turkey and there's five fans here, etc., etc. Do you believe that there could be a bit of like, this isn't expected?
No, there'll be a grace period, and I think there'll be a degree of humility as well, while they kind of get used to... I think they have to do some of the hard yards before they can start critiquing the series and saying, well, guys, what are we doing here? Why are we investing in this? I don't think that's going to happen for a couple of years, you know, because they're going to be too focused on their own stories. And also, even though they are part of the MSMA, the Manufacturers Association, and can be asking for slightly different stuff, like not running numbers on the side plates, then, you know, they still have to prove themselves in this world. So I don't think they're really in a position to do that. And they just, their attitude and the way they go racing means they won't. But, you know, there's not to say that in a couple of years they won't be banging their fist on the table when, say, In Front want to do 25 GPs instead of 20. I think there's some common ground where they'll be looking for a degree of quality. But, you know, maybe going to the likes of Turkey and racing in front of 150 fans, you know, I don't think they'll be really in a position to be too...
Does MotoGP have that? Flyaway races with no fans? Or is it always well attended?
It's a different structure because Dorna support the teams that much.
It doesn't matter.
No, but yeah, they freight everything around the world. There's no... Of course, the teams have to finance themselves, but then the satellite teams are paid for by Dorna as well. They essentially give them money to lease the bikes from the manufacturers. And, you know, they, like I say, they ship the championship around the world. You can't complain about going to Indonesia or Thailand, where there's still massive audiences for the sport, when your expenses are partly taken care of. And that's the crucial difference between MXGP and MotoGP, is that there is more cohesion with the teams and the promoters. But then MotoGP can lean on the TV contracts. They have the financial means to do that. Whereas in motocross, as David Longo has told us in interviews, they are paying broadcasters to take the motocross thing. I'm really interested to see what, and this was something we were talking about amongst us, you know, the journalists at the Ducati press conference. What happens in the future? I think MXGP has to pivot somehow. It can't keep running this large, lengthy four moto television package because it's antiquated. It's not going to generate any kind of new audience when sports are trying to react to this changing media landscape and find, you know, the kind of reach that they need to justify the sponsors. I think you have to have, like I've said, one moto to present on TV and maybe one at the tracks for the fans.
I remember being like 14 years old and reading your articles about that subject. Dear. You have beat that drum for so long.
Yeah, and Jorge was saying on the Pulp Show, you know, go back to, you know, one day format. I support that. Go, if you're spending money to go to a Grand Prix, fair play to you, because I think to spend any money to follow anything these days is a commitment, when you can just sit at home on your huge comfortable sofa and watch something on TV, have something on your iPad, and then be communicating with someone on your phone. You don't need to move your ass. So to get off your ass and go in a camper or a hotel and spend money going to a track, fair play. And when you go there, you need to have a full kind of gamut of entertainment and spectacle. That's why they have to do stuff like the Paddock Show. Oh. All day Saturday, you should be able to watch kids riding electric bikes, or you should see the latest crop of youngsters in European championships. And on Sunday, you should have the cream of the crop on a decently prepared track putting on a show.
Yeah, MXGP, especially with the talent changing so drastically in the coming years, MXGP has to act now. Because otherwise... Yeah, it won't be in a very healthy spot.
Make more of the European Championship. Make it more, give it more credence, more billing.
But how can they do that? It already gets equal to...
Just giving it its own day on Saturday.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Scrap the qualification heat. I mean, they've given it points to try and make it more important, whether it's a coercive method or not. Just do that on, do it all day on Sunday. And on Saturday, if you've got zero interest in a European, you want to see Jorge Prado doing some promotion on a gas stand... Great, go and, you know, he'll be there for an hour signing autographs. You love Jorge Prado, you wear his cap, go and meet him, and then watch him race on the Sunday. I don't think it's such a bad format. And then for TV package, just do the second moto on TV, live, the whole shebang with a podium. If Jorge Prado crashes his brains out in the first moto, but then comes back in the second and smokes everyone, he's the winner of that Grand Prix.
Not to be super negative, are you excited for MXGP, and or... And or do you feel like
MXGP's growth or just MXGP generally?
Just MXGP this year. Do you almost feel like this is... I feel like this is the quietest MXGP discussion, MXGP hype has ever been. We are... The preseason races start in two weeks?
Yeah, less. Next week.
And what discussion is there? There isn't any sort of buzz or there's no media coverage. There's no... The MXGP social channels are dead. Yeah. Atrocious. There's not much, and it's sad because, like, these riders are our friends. We have great relationships with a lot of people in that paddock, and I don't like hearing Prado say how he feels so much more appreciated and like his position as an athlete means more here, because I want him and Jeffrey and Sua and Jonas and Ben to feel like they get what they deserve in MXGP.
I think, you've been talking about media coverage on sort of, you know, your podcast over here, and it's why? I mean, people might think, well, we don't give a shit about it, but you should, because the way you digest the sport is changing. I mean, there is, I think MXGP in front, the crew there have always been really supportive, I think, of the press, but they need to look at new ways of how the coverage is being transmitted and what journalists are there. You're not going to be there for the majority of the races this year. I haven't been there for a couple of years. There are people out there producing good stuff. I gatedrop.com do a really good job in posting news and giving updates. There's journalists like Ed Stroutman who have like a lot of passion for you know, delivering content. But otherwise, you know, outside of Instagram videos and photos, there's not real any depth. And if there's no depth for you to get into, then you don't relate to the riders. There's no kind of examination of the racing. There's no kind of hard engagement beyond 10 to 15 second imagery. Yeah. That is the problem with MXGP. And its antiquated nature, I think, is something that's something very rock solid about it, but then also something that, you know, it's not really adjusting or molding to the times.
For some reason MXGP's press room is full of 15 second Instagram people, and for some reason MXGP feel like that is great, because I believe that someone somewhere told MXGP social media is important, and they went, oh, they're doing a video for social media, cool, we did that. And it's like, not like there's no... As I said, I told this before, when I went to my first GP last year, the reaction to riders, because they were so happy to do a stupid little interview with me, was sad. I felt so, like, this is just pathetic. Like Prado, oh, yeah, I'll do it in, like, literally, it was like I just offered him €1 million. Because they're, like, but it's sad. This is, like, I don't know what... And okay, there aren't really any journalists there, or there's very few. So MXGP needs to hold the fort down and make their content, their giving more informative, more gripping, more eye-catching, just more than just, like...
Because it's not coming through live TV, because the model has been the same for so long.
I can't wait to hear Lisa Leyland stand on the start straight and go, so how are you feeling about the race? And then we'll do a jazzy transition. We'll have a wide shot of the start gate after that with the start... Like, it's... Yeah. You can recite the script now.
Something needs to be shaken up a little bit. I agree. I think you need to have some sort of specialist who is looking at how people are digesting MXGP. And if it is just Instagram clips, then you're only going to have so much level of engagement, I think, with the sport. And, you know, you want people to be coming there. You want them to be curious about the riders and the teams and the colours and the personalities. And Maybe I'm just too old for it, but I think you're just tapping the surface of it with the way it is currently.
Do you agree? I believe it is a travesty. Prado has raced 4 Supercrosses. MXGP has not given him one, not even an Instagram post. Now, some people have hit me back with, why would they promote a rival series? But
that's the most obvious reaction.
Well, the unison between Feld in front, MX Sports is better than ever. Supercross isn't an item that in front currently dabble in, so there's no competition there, and Prado is crucially coming home. If Prado had moved here full time, I get it, you're not going to give him that much love, but your world champion is coming home shortly, so yeah. you need to the new fans that Prado has, and he does have them now. This is sad as well. He won a heat race. I know he loved that. In retrospect, it means very little. Like, it's winning a qualifier.
It's better than finishing eighth.
True. But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't mean much. His Instagram post about winning a heat race had more likes than his Instagram post about being MXGP world champion.
Oh, wow.
And that was the moment when I was like, oh my God.
I think, like I said earlier, the hibernation aspect of MXGP is something, again, that it really needs to change. And that's something I see in MotoGP as well, where the American COO, no, or CCO, going, we're having real CO problems on this podcast.
I'm having a lot of problems.
Dan Rossomondo wants to change, because when the sport finishes in November and doesn't start again until the end of January, beginning of February, then that you have a real dearth of, it's, you know, your sport vanishes from the map. Apart from a few season reviews and whatever else, you know, there's no content whatsoever. And if you compare it to other American sports where they're drip feeding stuff all the time, there's a draft or there's some sort of tournament, there's constant recycling of news, then that's something where, you know, the promotion just is not good enough. I know they're trying to fix that in MotoGP. And again, it's something that motocross, when it finishes, what, at the end of September and doesn't really fire up again, I mean, it takes 5 months off.
Yeah.
That's also just this vacuum where I think Jorge's fallen into.
Last two tweets from MXGP. Send it Sunday like Maximilian Spies with his KTM during his home Grand Prix on the famous jump of Tuchental. And jump into the weekend like Glenn Koldenhoff sending this huge triple in St. John D'Angeli. Like... Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to follow that series. That sounds exciting. That reads like an FMX show.
But we can't be too cynical, Lewis. We know what the machine behind it, and unless you really are prepared to invest in expertise and personnel to make that happen. I mean, you said something about McLaren doing their teaser post on Twitter recently.
Oh.
But McLaren's media department is probably the size of half of in-front motor racing's on-site
crew.
No, but
you can dip, dive, dodge with social media and content to make... You can make a lot out of very little. You can dip, dive, dodge. Like, it's Sunday. Prado is on a flight home right now. Welcome home, at Jorge Prado. We can't wait to have our MXGP champion back on European shores after his American vacation. How do you think he fared? Engagement through the roof. Instead, Maximilian Spies sent a jump at some point last year. Like, and I realise that this is, honestly, so, you know what? This is more of a private conversation. I'm struggling at the moment with, like, what's next? My entire career I've had, like, this next plan. I'm going to do post-race podcasts. Okay, I'm going to do this. I need to get better at writing. I need to move to America, etc., etc., etc. And now I'm in America, I'm like, what's my next move? What's my next goal? Like, I really don't know. I'm really, like, finding my...
You need to be a social media guru, obviously.
I'm treading water a little bit at the moment. Like, I don't know what my purpose in life is. I'm gonna really make a push to make the sport better in this area.
I think you'd look quite fetching in an in-front grey shirt.
It's a terrible colour. It's hot as some of those races. I've offered to do that for free. I'm in America full time. Full transparency. I would run their Twitter account for free for 1 year. And it would be the most fun I have, because it's I want it to be better.
But it's a monster, you know. When you sort of start taking care of it, you've got to feed it, you've got to maintain it. You know, speaking as a father of two, it's a big old job.
But like, even team PRs, there's no communication. There's no, like, the sport is very archaic in that way. We all just believe. And I'm not talking just MXGP now. I will say Feld do a phenomenal job with Supercross's social media. More recently, there was definitely a shift, I would say, at the beginning of last year, where they really started to understand what they were doing. But aside from that, I feel like the entire sport looks at PR, social media, communication as, have we ticked that box? Yep. No one's saying, have we ticked that box well?
Yeah. Yeah, goodness.
It really frustrates me. And yeah. I, from what I see from very, very far away, MotoGP does have similar issues.
Yes, they tried to address it more. And it was a little dispiriting to see the opening ceremonies video for Supercross and just riders doing dumb shit, waving their arms. Obviously catering to a below 15 age group. Fair enough, but I don't think there's a need for it before a major, major sporting event. You go from the... kind of serious nature of the national anthem 1 minute to that kind of goofy behavior the next. I thought Jet Lawrence's sort of opening video was shot almost like a music video. I mean, there was an element of class to that. That's the sort of thing you need to be aiming for. And somebody was telling me this recently in Austria, you know, these are guys who are risking their lives doing an extreme hazardous sport. They're not clowns. They're not, you know, people that we should be laughing at, or, you know, there's a degree of, I think, edginess where you have to present the sport. There is, I mean, if you want to make kind of these memes of them and stuff just to try and get the kids on board, fair enough, give it a go, but don't make it the main sort of thrust of your promotion. So that's just one thing where I'm, well, again, maybe I'm showing my age.
But that's where, like, as media, like, well, not you, because you do, you're the best at this, and I'm trying to get better at it. Like, we as media need to give these riders the coverage, the storylines that they deserve. We need to give them, we don't need to ask them if they like the color of their bike. We need to ask them something in depth that shows their personality and shows just how amazing they are.
But the worrying thing as well is, as younger riders, as the sport keeps recycling, if people are not asking them those kind of questions, then they never really get used to answering them. You know, I think if you go and interviewed, say, Jeremy McGrath now, compared to, say, pick a name, Jet Lawrence, maybe the way to answer the questions and deal and to transmit your thoughts, you know, there's a whole generational change there. McGrath was one of the best interviews I've done, just because he had the experience and the maturity to know this is the material I need to give, you know, for a long form article.
I've said this a million times, and I'll say it again, maybe for the last time. That interview I did with Hurlings last year, that opened my eyes as to how underserved that kind of medium is, because it went far and wide. It, even for someone like me who knows Jeffrey very well, it showed him in a new light to me even. I understood him as a person more, and I kind of drove away from his house thinking, like, every rider needs to be given this same sort of exposure and this same sort of platform.
And you're talking about one of the probably the most interviewed riders in MXGP. Yeah. You know, a guy who's fluent in fantastically in two languages at least. So he knows what to do, what to say. I mean, he's also had his fingers burned from perhaps being too outspoken in the past. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if people are just used to doing 45-second interview clips for video, then, you know, there's a whole side of it that you're, I mean, are you only going to be interested in riders for the weird shit that they do on Instagram stories in the future? Or do you actually want to know a little bit more about what motivates them and what makes them want to grab another rider's chin bar and what makes them take risks or want to run other riders off the track? You know, I would like to read a long form article of, like, Vince Friese, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to know why he is the way he is. You know, do it. Don't just slam the guy continue on social media. Give a proper article about this guy's approach to life and to racing. I mean, if you're not interested in that, then I don't think you're really interested in sport as much as you think you are.
Yeah, I would like to call Lucas Myrtle and see if I can get an interview now with Jet and talk about, like, the mental roller coaster of winning your first 450 race, every lap led, to then being the hero, becoming the villain so quickly, having to deal with the on-track, the tough realization that on-track activity is not harder than you expected, but maybe the road is a little more turbulent than expected. And then also, wait, everyone's booing me? What? Like,
yeah.
The mental side of that is fascinating.
Well, it's ironic that we're sitting here doing a podcast, but, you know, I would just like to, people listening to this, how do you like to digest your sport, your racing and your motocross? Do you like listening to idiots like us, or do you actually seek out in-depth articles that are presenting different sides of these people that you actually quite admire? Or are you happy just to, like, sit on the toilet and flick through Instagram and say,
well, make
our
lives easier,
that was a great you know, some great passing there, that's your fill, that's all you need? I mean, I'm sort of curious as to what people want.
Yeah, so am I. Like, I am in a weird spot at the moment. I feel like I'm really a bit confused. Anything else do you want to talk about, or should we go?
No, I think that's a very long show, and I hope
it's only an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
An hour and 5 minutes.
Maybe because it's so close to lunch. It's just that I'm hungry.
Okay, well, thank you to Polisport for their support, their continued support. Thank you to All Balls Racing for their new support. And thank you to EVS. We'll have more from those new sponsors coming up. I would like to continue to evolve this show. I like the fact that there's no other show like it. I believe that we can do more here to tell good stories and show personalities. Are you still Adam Wheeler from On Track Off Road?
I
noticed in the press conference you were Adam Wheeler from Various.
Yeah, I just, it's, you know, if you're freelance and you're not from one particular entity, then why, you know, just Various.
Adam Wheeler from Miscellaneous.
Yes, in limbo.
But big things for you this year.
Book, yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to probably be boring people to death talking by about it. But yeah, I need to really get my skates on writing that. But it's exciting. And like, again, talking, I'm biased towards long form content, but when you sit down and you can get creative and imaginative about stuff, then that's what I prefer to do. You say you're looking for your next direction and where you want to go, then I think once you nail that, then you're going to be on a happy path.
Well, let's keep track of whether I find it. Thank you to the sponsors. Thank you to you, Adam Wheeler. Thank you to everyone for listening to this. I've been Lewis Phillips. This has been the MXGP podcast show on Vital MX on the Sunday after Anaheim 2. We will see you probably in a couple of weeks for some sort of MXGP preview, pre-season reaction, I would imagine. Thank you for listening.